phone with us now is Nathan Latka. He is the author of How to Be a Capitalist Without Any Capital. Nathan, thank you for joining us on Mound Money.
Doug, Roger, thank you both for having me.
So, Nathan, let's start with why you wanted to write this book and who the audience that you envision, who can be helped by this book?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you, you know, my background isn't writing. I mean, my podcast, The Top Entrepreneurs, did very well. We feature business owners every day. A lot of them, actually, many from Utah, they caught Silicon Slopes out there. You guys have had a lot of CEOs building great companies. And so I have them on the show for 20 minutes a day. And what happened was some of these CEOs had books, and I'd have them on the show and we'd sell a lot of books. And then publishers said, Nathan, have you thought about writing a book? And I said, well, no, but if I did, I'd write one on how to be a capitalist without any capital. And so that was the genesis of the book.
And your story, Nathan, I take it, is one that tracks that. I mean, you started founding businesses while you were an undergraduate in Blacksburg. Is that right?
That's right. Now, are you familiar with Blacksburg, or you just did your research and you know that's Virginia Tech?
A little of both. I must confess to having a degree from the University of Virginia.
Oh, my God. I'm hanging up right now. Goodbye.
But tell us a little bit about how that happened, Nathan.
No, I'm just kidding. We love UVA. But, no, I was studying architecture at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg and quickly realized, you know, when I was a sophomore, junior, there were no jobs for architects. And this is 09, so nobody was building. And, you know, Virginia Tech wasn't, you know, a bad school for architecture. In fact, it was ranked number one for architecture in the country that year, above Cornell, Harvard, et cetera. So great program. And I just, you know, Doug Roger had a ton of fear. And I said, I better figure out a way to sell something of my own product that I have control of. Otherwise, I'm going to end up in student debt with a job I don't like and trying to work that debt off for the next decade of my life. And so that's when I started kind of pre-selling Facebook fan pages. And we grew that on page 6 in the book. You see my tax return. I actually put it in the book. My lawyers didn't like that, but I had to put in the proof where we passed about $939,000 in sales that year and had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, so you know that was an unusual time, and there's always these pivot points for businesses, right? There was a time where no companies had web pages 25 years ago, right? And then everybody had to have a web page, and there was an opportunity for consultants to build people's web pages. You did yours 20 years later. The new thing was Facebook pages. Companies had to have Facebook pages, so there was a big demand taking place. And one of the things that's nice about your book is you talk about, you know, you don't have to have an idea, some ways to come up with, I shouldn't say you don't need an idea. You don't need an original idea. You don't need to come up with the next Facebook. And you talk about different ways to come up with ideas to start businesses. And I want to go there, but first I want to get to the foundation of your book, which one of your main points is the past rules are not as relevant today as they were at one time. For instance, you say that Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which is a very popular book, you say it's no longer relevant. Talk to us about that. Why is the advice in a book like that less relevant today than it was 15 years ago?
Well, and I have to tell you, the day I realized this, I was so sad because I grew up on Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and later 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss. But let me just give you an example. When Guy put together, again, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, this was a book where you had cash flow quadrants, and he'd say, you know, Nathan, you know, one of the big liabilities, most people's biggest liabilities, is your house. Why? Because it sucks cash from you. You have a mortgage payment. Well, today, I mean, look, there's a chapter in the book, page 31, I talk about how I essentially live like a king in Blacksburg, Virginia, in the most expensive apartment in the town because it was right above the local theater, right downtown on College Avenue. But I live there for free because I rented out one of the side rooms for more than my total rent was, right? And that was via Airbnb. So you know, Airbnb has essentially turned what used to be, as Rich Dad Poor Dad would say, a huge liability into something that you can actually turn into a massive asset. The same is true for your cars. It used to be a liability. There's a car payment, right? Or there's a loan you're paying off. Today, you can use sites like Turo and things like this where other people can actually use your car instead of you having it just parked in a garage and you make, you know, 30, 40 bucks an hour from that. So all these things are now assets. And that's what a lot of the book is, are 36 screenshots, negotiations, tools, bank negotiations, things like this that help people turn their old liabilities into massive cash flow assets.
And you talk about, you know, the first sort of one of the four rules that Doug alluded to was this notion of selling, you know, pickaxes rather than gold. And this is the notion of, I think the rule is articulated as follow a hot opportunity. Actually, don't follow a hot opportunity. Can you talk a little bit about why you think that and how that works?
Yeah, the rule that most people believe is go after the hot opportunity. So today, that might be cannabis, right? A year ago, it might have been Bitcoin, right, or blockchain. The people that have built the most wealth over the longest periods of time are not the ones that go after the very risky, hot trend today. What they do are they build in a much kind of easier place to get rich, which is the thing that supports the hot topic, right? And so an example of this, you know, we look at Mr. Levi back in the 1800s. He went west to mine for gold. That was the hot thing to do. And he's in the mines bleeding and sweating and dirt on his hands, and he hates it. And he looks around and says, wow, everyone's wearing jeans. I'm going to invent a jeans brand called Levi, and I'm going to sell jeans to the gold miners. And then later he sold them pickaxes and other tools and hats. And today, Levi's is a massive jean brand. But no one's mining for gold in the California gold rush anymore. That's because when you piggyback off a trend, you actually end up with more longevity than the trend itself. And trends by nature go out of style or out of trend. So the lesson here is you want to sell pickaxes to gold miners. Don't follow the hot opportunity. Rather, sell into it.
Well, let's give our audience an example. This is a business radio show. It's on community radio. It's a publicly owned radio station. We're an NPR affiliate here in Park City. But our show is not that dissimilar from your podcast, Nathan. You run a podcast where you're talking to business leaders. You do an interview every day. This is a weekly show. But in Roger and I's case, and we have a third co-host, Renee, you know, this Renee's the manager of the station, but Roger and I, this is one of the ways we give back to our community by volunteering to host this show. In your case, your podcast has turned into a really nice business opportunity. So give our audience an example. Like in our case, we do this show, it gets archived, and it's a service to the community. In your case, you do a podcast and it's a business. How did you turn your business podcast into a business?
Well, first off, you have to believe that there's a big future for audio, which I believe there is. You're seeing hardware now catch up with the invention of AirPods or Alexa or Google Home. So the hardware is there for audio consumption. Then there's talented folks like you guys, myself, many other thousands and thousands of people creating huge amounts of audio content. So I launched my podcast back in August of 2015, had on some great guests, grew it to about 2 million downloads fairly rapidly. And then on that date, it was February of 2016, so 6 months after launch, you guys see on page 18 of the book, I got an email from someone that wanted to sponsor on the show asking how many downloads I got and what I charged. And I said, well, heck, I have no idea. So, but I didn't want to seem like immature, like I was inexperienced. So I said, well, our standard sponsorship rates are, and put out some numbers to see how they'd react. And I ended up signing my first $6,400 sponsor agreement. Now, today, the podcast does many millions in terms of sponsor revenue, but that all started first off by me just doing the show because I liked it. And I told myself, much like you guys, I'm going to give back to the business community. I'm going to do this for a year, every day, even if nobody listens and I make no money from it. And with that mindset, it turns out, you know, 4, 5, 6 months in, we got our first kind of sponsor and it began making money fairly rapidly.
Now, Nathan, I want to go one layer deeper with your podcast because through these interviews, you find out some interesting information about these companies and the CEOs, and you found a way to monetize that as well. Talk to the audience about that.
Well, this I can't take a lot of credit for. It wasn't strategic and it was an accident I stumbled on, but I believe a lot of success is luck. And so put this in my luck category. What happened was I asked every CEO, I say, what's your revenue? What was your valuation? How much money have you raised? What's your salary? What do you pay yourself? How much cash do you have in the bank? Very personal questions to these CEOs. And we built a piece of code, a program that basically recognizes all that data in the audio file and puts it in a big Excel sheet at getlatka.com, getlatka.com. And then that data we sell to private equity firms, investment bankers in Utah and all over the country, venture capitalists, again, all over the biggest names, they use it to get deal flow. And so that's now another revenue stream that, that we built on top of the podcast or on top of this bigger trend of, again, the explosion of audio.
And so in a sense, we're doing an interview that, that's running on two tracks. We're talking about the way you've built businesses on the one track, and the other on the other track, the advice you have for other people to find out how to build their own businesses. And I want to go back to some of your other rules because I thought they were really interesting. Another one that you say is that the traditional notion of focusing on one goal is misguided in the current environment. And I know, you know, when I was growing up, that was something that we were always taught, that that was the way to success. Find a goal and go for it. Why is that wrong?
Goals are so dangerous because you end up in a loop. You say, oh, I'm going to save up for a house. That's the goal. Then you save up for 3 years for a house, then you buy the house. And then you're going to save up so you have enough income in the bank to have a kid. Right. And then you're going to save up for a family vacation and boom, boom. And these are like these goals. And you, again, you end up in this cycle. What's much more powerful, and people maybe articulate this as enjoy the process, but you want to actually build systems, not goals, and know that the systems you're building will get to a point where they automatically produce these goals for you, no matter what happens to, you know, the macro environment around you. And the lesson or the analogy I use here are, again, a lot of people focus on the golden egg, right? But what you want, and that golden egg could be the Rolex watch that you saw Roger Federer wearing during Wimbledon or the Versace dress you saw Kim Kardashian wearing. It doesn't matter. But what you want to focus on instead of the golden goose, or sorry, the golden egg is the golden goose. You want to keep the goose happy. You want to feed it. You want to keep it healthy, keep it hydrated so that it pumps out golden eggs on kind of command, almost automated. And so you want to set this, you want to set up systems, not double down your time and focus on goals.
Now, Nathan, I think Roger and I would both agree with you on the value of systems. But the way you share that, you know, that goals are dangerous is in kind of a shocking manner. Are you doing that on purpose to emphasize it? Or do you really think that, you know, saving for a house is a dangerous goal and that sets people back?
No, I think what's more powerful is to realize, you know what, I should be thinking every day about it, not about how to make more money and keep more of my money, decrease expenses, and know that if I do that every day, that's a system that eventually, I don't know when it will be, but eventually I'll be able to buy whatever house I want. That's way more powerful, in my opinion, than going, again, we are trained as humans to go after that big, hairy, audacious goal. I mean, there are books on goal setting, tons of bestsellers. But it's such an emotional drain. A lot of people, they set a goal, they never hit it. It sits on their to-do list forever. Systems are much. You can build on a system and feel the momentum every day. Goals, you really, most of the momentum you feel when you hit it. You feel it for a very short period of time, and then you're bored again, or you have a brand new goal you want to go after. You spend another year building. So no, I mean I'm not saying this for shock value. Goals can be very, very dangerous. You should focus on systems every day.
Okay, and I know Roger's going to get us back to kind of the four rules that you share in your book, but I do want to, you talked about one of your processes is, you know, thinking about how to control your expenses, and I thought it was interesting in your book where you share about how you decide whether to splurge or not. For instance, you go to the Oscars every year, you talk about splurging for staying in an expensive hotel room in Hollywood for that event. What's your advice for people when they're trying to decide, you know, should I pay $500-$700 a night for a hotel for kind of a fun one-time thing?
The answer is, if you can't pay for that one-time splurge every single day and basically make that your lifestyle, don't do it once. That's my basic rule. And look, decision-making takes up a lot of people's time and energy, and they don't realize it, like what you're going to wear in the morning, right? I wear the same thing every day so that I save all my decision-making power for important things. So this is a way that I save my decision-making power when I'm making decisions about more expensive things, like, again, spending $20,000 on a Tom Ford suit, these shoes I'll only wear once, and, again, going to the Oscars. If I feel like I can't do that thing, like, and do it on repeat, right, like, you know, once a day or once a month or once a week, whatever is appropriate in terms of frequency. But if you can't afford it in that frequency, don't do it one time. A lot of times what will happen is you'll get addicted to that kind of lifestyle, and then you'll spend all the money you make trying to keep up with that lifestyle instead of, you know, making sure the things that you're splurging on are actually things where if you wanted to, if you loved it enough, you've enjoyed the splurge enough, you could actually make it your lifestyle. It's just a mindset thing there, and it helps me make decisions faster.
So it's almost not a splurge in that sense. What you're really saying is don't put yourself into a situation where your future expectations are inconsistent with your financial abilities.
That's another way to put it, but I would consider it a splurge. I consider a splurge to be something where, you know, you spend a lot of money on things you usually wouldn't spend a lot of money on, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, that to me is a splurge. Now, the reason I go, wow, this is something I could do every day is because I'm really good at saving money, right, and keeping money I make. So when I say splurge, it just means an expense that's larger or in a category that I wouldn't usually spend money in.
Okay. Another one of the rules that you tell us, and I really enjoyed your rules because I thought they were really good points of departure for the points you were trying to make. And the other one that I want to touch on is that the notion of being unique is not the way to get rich.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, again, Utah's a great community. I'm sure you guys have startup events all the time. You ever, you know, meet the guy or gal that comes up and says, you know, Doug, Roger, I've got a great idea. I really want to tell you the idea. And they pull out their backpack and they pull out a one pager and you're like, oh my God, they're about to ask me to sign an NDA to just hear the idea. I mean, it's ridiculous. These are the kinds of people that believe their idea is what's going to help them win. And it couldn't be further from the truth. In today's world, there are no brand new, totally unique ideas. Unless you're a billionaire, you're inventing Tesla or going to the moon, right? And even those are copying patterns from other places in life to then put them together to then go achieve those things. My point here is a lot of people don't give themselves permission to ruthlessly copy their competitors, right? Because actually, the reason this is dangerous is because that's actually the less risky approach. It's actually a more surefire way to build wealth. Copy the exact idea that somebody else is doing and then double down on your ability to out-execute versus trying to double down on your ability to come up with some brand new, unique idea no one's ever thought of, because it'll get replicated and copied. And by the way, the wealthiest people on earth do this. Facebook ruthlessly copies Snapchat on every feature they release. They admit it. They don't even try and hide it. I mean, Instagram is a clone or has a clone of every Snapchat feature. And guess what? Snapchat's value is slowly decreasing because of it, because Facebook is out-executing. This copycat stuff happens everywhere. The problem is most people, especially ones that don't have wealth yet, feel like it's evil or unethical or dirty or slimy. And until they get those negative thoughts out of their head about copying, they're generally going to pursue ideas that are extremely risky because they're brand new, unique ideas that, quote unquote, haven't existed before. And the catch is, Doug, Roger, you guys know this, maybe there's a reason no one's done that before, because there's no money to be made.
Yeah, no, that's the old adage. I do a little investing in startup companies, and oftentimes with these unique ideas, the first question as an investor I ask myself is, well, why has nobody done this in the past? It doesn't mean it's not going to work. You know, and one of the things I like about your book, Nathan, is it encourages people to get out there and do it. You know, oftentimes when I talk to folks, you know, there's three main reasons they don't start a company. They don't have an idea. They don't have the resources to execute it. Maybe they don't know how to code. And they don't have capital. And your book talks about all of that. In fact, the third point is the title of your book. Let's talk about the lack of an idea. We talked about copying ideas. And you talk in your book, page 62, there's a lot of ways that you list how to come up with an idea by looking at what's working now. Share a few of those ideas with our audience.
Yeah. You're talking about page 61, where I say, look in these seven places to find your next $5,000. And the reason I put that title out there is because there are a lot of sites out there that will help you basically get ideas. And so one of the things I like to do, like when I have free time, is I'll go to something like Kickstarter and just look at what is trending on Kickstarter, what projects are trending, which means they're getting a lot of funding. Maybe you should build a product in that same space. Additionally, you can leverage online learning platforms like Udemy or Creative Live. In fact, there's a guy named Mark Prince, which launched a course on coding on Udemy. It did so well, he even launched a software product on top of his course called DevSlopes. And so after teaching to 40,000 students, he launched DevSlopes. Today he's got 130 students paying him $20 a month for total recurring revenue of $2,600 per month, right? So, like, there are so many places to look for your next side hustle. And they don't require capital up front. And many times it's just you're going to copy a competitor and then outscale them. For you guys, Doug, Roger, and me, right, you can go to patreon.com and actually see other people creating audio content in the form of podcasts. And you can actually see how much money they're making. Like the Chapo Trap House podcast, It has 21,863 people paying $97,000 per month total. That's page 64 in the book. So you can get ideas here on how these other audio streams are monetizing themselves and copy some of the monetization strategies. So yeah, that was the goal of the book. Is, and my publisher didn't like this, by the way, because you guys read it. I mean, there's a ton of screenshots in here of, you know, ideas like this and screenshots and email statements and scripts. And so the book really, I mean, it will work today, but these things probably won't work 3-4 years from now. These are things where the early bird kind of gets the worm. So the first buyers have the biggest advantage, and a big advantage is there, Doug, you cited on page 62, the places to look to start your next side hustle.
Well, Nathan, we enjoyed talking to you. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up. I do have one last question for you, and that is, when you wrote the book, you were 29 years old. Hitting 30 is a milestone for a lot of people. It causes them to reflect back, look at their lives. And I'm curious, how are your views different now maybe than when you turned 20? And you know, how has that 10 years shaped your outlook on life?
Well, I've just realized opportunity is everywhere, right? I mean, I was very fortunate to be 20 when I started it. Well, actually 19 when I started this in my dorm room. You know, I had food from the dining halls. I had a shelter over my head because I was in a dorm room. Like, I had no responsibilities. So, like, that is the time to take risks. And I think a big problem with society today is people that have no responsibilities right now are being burdened with a huge responsibility in the form of student debt, which decreases their ability to take risks. So company creation actually today is an all-time low in terms of kind of small businesses in the United States. And a lot of it's because graduates have so much debt, they can't take risks to launch their own company. They got to go take a secure job to pay it off, which only gives the employers leverage, right, around talent, which means they can potentially, you know, pay less and things like this. So what I've learned over the past decade is when you're, you know, under 30, under 40, you basically want to take risks as early and often as you can. Even after you have kids and a family, you want to see if you can structure your lifestyle in a way that allows you, maybe if it's even for 6 hours a week, to dedicate that 6 hours to taking some crazy random risk, because those things are what will pay off and give you financial freedom in the long run.
All right. Well, we thank you for joining us. Our guest this morning has been Nathan Lotka. He is the author of the book, How to Be a Capitalist Without Any Capital, The 4 Rules You Must Break to Get Rich. We talked about 2 of those rules. We didn't talk about all 4. To hear the rest of them, to learn the rest of them, suggest you buy Nathan's book. Nathan, thank you for joining us this morning.
Doug, Roger, that's great. And if people can't afford the book, they can get a great, big, beautiful free preview at capitalistbook.com.